So welcome. I am the Reverend Tracy Springberry. I use the pronouns she and her. And it is my delight to serve this warm, thankful, justice-seeking congregation. You are all welcome here. You're welcome here if it's your very, very first time. You're welcome here if you've been coming for 60 years. You are welcome if you are feeling thankful and joyful this morning. And you are thankful if you, and you are welcome if you are not feeling that way. You're welcome if you feel so much excitement inside you about the coming weeks of the holidays. And you are welcome if you are looking at them with stress or dread. Every person is welcome here, no matter who you are or where you come from, because you are a beloved child of this universe. So we are serving coffee downstairs after the service, and if you are online this morning, there will be a conversation, and you can bring your own coffee to that conversation right after the service, and the link is in your in the email that came this morning. Now I'd like to have everybody take a moment and greet each other, and please greet somebody.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
This is my group. This is the lead.
the lead
we're working group on the name.
Yeah. I don't know. I like band. Liz Hart and Friends.
We're going to sing a song by a band called Old Crow Medicine Show. The song's called I Hear Them All.
Benevolence upon us, hear this
Thank you so much. That was great. So we will begin our service by lighting our chalice. We light this flame, a precious light, burning the old with a fierce brightness that guides us to a new world. Let us nurture this precious light. And let us say our affirmation. Let us open our eyes to see what is beautiful and what is wondrous. Let us open to our mind to learn what is true and what is mysterious. Let us open our hearts to love one another and our neighbors.
Hello. My name is Brad Hewitt. My pronouns are he and him. It's my joy to be your lay leader this morning. Today's reading is by Naomi King, and it's a responsive reading. After I speak, please respond with, "Nurture this precious light." How shall we begin to live out our free faith?
Nurture this precious light.
When we do, we are beacons of freedom, creating a safe place to rest, explore, and innovate.
Nurture this precious light.
How we keep this lamp of truth and justice, which affects, and how whether we are transforming inequity through witness and action.
Nurture this precious light.
As we nurture this precious light together, we become a light of hope, turning isolation into community, anguish into peace, and sorrow into joy. As we do, our faith burns a steady flame of innovation, banishing illusion, creating a new and renewing way together. With our living connections, with our glowing stories, with our flame of freedom moving hand to hand, we
nurture this precious light.
Together, we turn this world from bleak to bright, one flame, one fire, one light at a time.
Nurture this precious light.
Thank you.
So we are going to affirm our board this year, right now. It has not been WOLF's tradition to recognize and affirm our leaders during our services, but this is something that we're going to start doing. And so right now we're going to affirm our board. We would install them, but they've been working for 6 months already. So, you know, we're getting to things. We do it at our speed. So I would like to invite the board members who are here up. That would be John Riles, who's our president, Joe Boyd, our vice president, Howard Baldwin, who's our treasurer, Tom Winters, Eric Tilton, who's our facilitator, Mary Yusui, and we have three people who are not present with us today. There's a lot of illness, it turns out. Mike Fish, who's our secretary, Carrie Tilton-Jones, and Jane Transier, who's our youth member. So at WOLF, we believe in a ministry that is shared among the members of the congregation and the minister. The task of ministry and service belongs to all of us by our words, by our actions, and by our living example. Yet some people take on some extra commitment. And one of the ways people do this is by serving on our board. And this position comes with responsibility, extra responsibilities, more time and effort. Your board is responsible for vision of our congregation, goal setting, and financial responsibility. Ministry and service done faithfully in love is the work of justice and community building. This is what you have asked these people before us this morning, that they will serve you faithfully and well. To do this, they need your trust and your support. And so I ask now the members of WOLF, will you love and trust your board, responding to them when they seek input, showing up when they tell you that work needs to be shared, and listening carefully when they speak of the life of the church, and thanking them profusely for the things that they do. If you will do this, please respond, "We will."
We will.
So, board, will you be diligent and faithful in your work, bringing your best selves, and practicing self-care and open-heartedness, tending with love the details and work, and always keeping the goal of beloved community in front of you as you serve? If so, respond, "We will." May the spirit of love guide you. May a joy infuse you with the work as you engage. And may your service bless us all. Amen. Thank you so much. So now it's time for all ages. And so if there's any children here who would like to come to the front row, you are so welcome to. Our story this morning, you're welcome to stay in your seats as well. It's totally up to you. So the story this morning is The Secret of Saying Thanks by Douglas Wood, illustrated by Greg Shedd. The world is full of secrets, gentle, shy things that some people know and some people don't. The best secrets are the ones that make us happy. Perhaps you'd like to know a secret, one of the happiest secrets of all. You might discover the secret at dawn. The sun climbs up over the edge of the earth and begins to fill the world with light and with warmth. And you say softly, simply, "Thanks. Thank you, sun, for the gift of a new day." Or sometime perhaps you'll notice a flower and thank it for the grace of its blossoms and the sweetness of its breath, for coloring your path and reminding you how easy it is to smile. Or you might discover the secret when you find yourself under an old tree, so grateful for the cool shade on a hot day, remembering the good and gentle gifts of trees all over the earth. One long day, you might rest upon a stone, a silent stone that's been waiting age upon age for someone to come along and just say thank you. Thank you, all stones and hills and mountains. Thanks for your silence and patience, for standing still and not changing in a world so full of noise and speed and change. You may find the secret when you hear a bird sing and feel grateful for the gentle music of the skies, for the good company of graceful creatures who dance upon the wind. And perhaps you'll remember to thank all creatures who swim or call or crawl or creep or burrow or climb or run. They remind us of the mystery and beauty of all life, and they save us from a great loneliness here on our small blue planet, sailing among the stars. And those stars themselves, tiny twinkling beams from far, far away that give just enough light for dreaming or wishing upon, don't forget to thank them. And beneath the moon, the earth's waters are spread with silver, lakes and rivers, ponds and puddles, streams and oceans. It is the waters that make the magic of life possible. Perhaps one day you will say, "Thanks. Thank you, waters, for sweet drinks, for cool swims, and for the gift of life itself." Maybe you'll first find the secret in your home, sitting around the table with people you love, giving thanks for good food and the good earth that gave it. Perhaps one day you'll feel the secret when someone is holding your hand or hugging you close or reading you a story or tucking you into bed at night and reminding you to say your prayers. I think that was that. I'm not sure. Or it may be in your bedtime prayer itself. Here we are. As you say thanks for the sun and the moon and the stars and the rocks and the trees and the flowers and the water and the birds and the animal and all those who love you and the love you feel for them. For here is the secret, if you have not already guessed it. The heart that gives thanks is a happy one, for we cannot feel thankful and unhappy at the same time. We don't say thanks because we're happy. We are happy because we give thanks. And so I would like everybody to take a moment to think of things that you are thankful for. And you can share that out into the room, or maybe type it online if you're out there, if you're online, or say it to a neighbor, or just quietly to yourself. So let's take a moment of gratitude.
Kind of interesting, when I came up with the reading for today, I had no idea what Tracy's book was going to be. May we whisper thank you for all that's good in our lives. May we shout thank you for the abundance of blessings. May we feel thank you, thank you, thank you, deep within our hearts and around us right now. May we take the time to feed each other, take care of each other, appreciate and trust each other, and say thank you. I now say thank you to you for your generous gift of presence here today as we take our offering. Your gifts, known and unknown, are what help make this congregation a family. And if one of those gifts is monetary support, those of you who are here in person, you may contribute to a basket that will be passed around, or the basket. Or if you're online, you'll see a way to donate there. Today is Donate the Basket Day, and our recipient is the Solidarity Brigade of the West. After Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico 5 years ago, the Solidarity Brigade of the West organized to help rural communities in need after heavy rains, earthquakes, and now this latest Hurricane Fiona. They also continue to support the communities in the western part of the island, much of which are still recovering today. Please make a donation to this self-help group, which is getting support from Puerto Ricans living in the States, but not much from their own government. Thank you. Let us join together in our affirmation of gratitude and giving. Let us
be grateful when we are able to give, for many do not have that privilege. Let us be grateful for all those who share their gifts with us, for we are enriched by their giving. And let us be grateful even for our needs, so that we may learn the generosity of others.
There is so much happiness in the world, goodness and beauty that grow within us and around us. Together, we create a circle of celebration deep enough to hold all the joys of our lives. There's also much pain in the world. Each of us knows loss and suffering. Together here, we create a circle of compassion wide enough to hold all the sorrow in our lives. Today, we hold transgender people across the world in our hearts as we recognize the Transgender Day of Remembrance, a day when we hold sacred all the people, mostly black trans women, who have been murdered just for being their true selves. We are also holding this morning the people who were killed, injured, or traumatically witnessed the mass shooting last night in Colorado at a jail LGBTQ bar. And as we enter this week of Thanksgiving, where people across the United States would gather with family and friends and remember to say thank you for all the gifts of these lives, that for Indigenous people in our country, this is a time of mourning, commemorating the devastation of colonialism and imperialism. This commemorates the struggles of Indigenous people everywhere. So now is a time when we can hold our own joys and sorrows and bring them into the waters of this community. You can come forward and place a stone in the water up front on the altar. The water is this community of compassion that bears all the sorrows. The water is the community of celebration that holds all of our joys. Please approach from this aisle. Now is time for our meditation, prayer, or reflection. Disturb us, Spirit, when we are pleased with ourselves, when our dreams have come true because we dreamed too little, when we arrived safely because we sailed too close to the shore. Disturb us, Spirit, when the abundance of things we possess With the abundance of things we possess, we have lost our thirst for the waters of life. Having fallen in love with life, we have ceased to dream of eternity. In our efforts to build a new earth, we have allowed our vision of the new heaven to dim. This is Emma's Revolution. I need some change.
Fun to see someone on the screen that's been here live on the stage, too. So if you missed them, it's quite a show. I don't remember that song, but I'm going to request it if they ever come back. That was awesome. I have three readings from the Christian Bible and then a reading from the Quran today. At the end of every 7 years, I'll give you the quote after the fact. At the end of every 7 years, you must cancel debts. This is how it's to be done. Every creditor shall cancel any loan they have made to a fellow Israelite. They shall not require payment from anyone among their own people, because the Lord's time of canceling debts has been proclaimed.
That's from the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 15, verses 1 through 11. You shall not lend your brother your money at interest. Leviticus, chapter 25, verse 37. If you lend money to any of my people with you who is poor, you shall not be like a moneylender to him, and you shall not exact interest from him. Book of Exodus 22, verse 25. And those who eat riba, meaning usury, will not stand on the day of resurrection, except like the standing of a person beaten by Shaitan, meaning Satan, leading him to insanity. That is because they say trading is only like riba, whereas Allah has permitted trading and forbidden riba. So whosoever receives an admonition from his Lord and stops eating riba shall not be punished for the past. His case is for Allah to judge. But whoever returns to riba, usury, such as the dwellers of the fire, they will abide therein. That's from the Quran, Al-Baraq, chapter 2, verse 275.
Did you know last week a federal Sharia court in Pakistan ruled that the country must transform to a non-interest banking system by 2027? The ruling is in keeping with Islamic teachings that charging or paying interest is wrong. In fact, Islamic banking has been growing across the Islamic world for quite a few years now. Not only is interest forbidden under Islamic teachings, but all those financial securities that bundle debt for people to speculate in are also not allowed, as well as a number of other practices. I suspect that you did not know this. I found out entirely by accident. I have spent this last week diving into all kinds of economic rabbit holes. I've been asking questions about the money supply and interest and inflation and fairness and economic growth. And I wanted to know if anyone was doing research advocating for interest-free economies. Wouldn't that be interesting, I thought? Somebody must be dreaming about it. So I typed interest-free economy into Google and got a weird smattering of articles from English versions of Islamic publications and citations from nearly incomprehensible research papers in journals I'd never heard of. It was bewildering, this weird smattering of almost information that I couldn't quite discern. I felt as if I'd gone down Alice's rabbit hole. Nothing seemed comprehensible about this. It was late. I'd had a glass of wine, and I considered the idea that perhaps I was in some fantasy corner of the internet. But in the morning, rested and better prepared with the keywords Islamic banking, I discovered not Alice's world, but a real Islamic, non-entrance financial system growing across the world. We don't think of religious traditions as advocating for or dictating the grounds of economic activity. Social norms. We see this both liberal and conservative face having opinions about that every day. What should the social norms be? But economic rules? That's secular. It is strange how this has come to pass. Really, it should have been the other way around. It turns out that the Bible mentions debt 800 times, and never positively. It speaks harshly of charging interest and advocates in the Old Testament for these jubilees where all debtors were released of debt every 7 years. It actually never mentions abortion once or trans issues, and it has only one verse that could possibly be construed to be anti-gay, which is where men are not supposed to have sex with each other as if one of them is a woman, but they don't forbid other sex acts. And that's also in Leviticus, which men are also forbidden to shave in Leviticus or sit where a menstruating woman previously sat. So It's hard. But economic relations are absolutely central to the Bible, as well as the Quran, which also speaks harshly of charging interest and discourages heavy debt among followers. But somehow, those who hold the Bible central to their morality are silent on one of the main issues that the Bible really, truly cares about, economic relations, and specifically the way we treat those who are less fortunate. I never thought I would agree with an Islamic court, but I do, in a general way. I believe it is the responsibility of people of faith who are committed to living their values to consider and attempt to create economic systems that fulfill our basic values. And I, like those who wrote the Bible, believe we need to shift economic relationships so it's likely that everyone has their basic needs met and everyone has the opportunity to flourish. Instead of our system, where economic insecurity for many and the acquisition of wealth by the few is written into the very bones of the system. For as long as I can remember, what has broken my heart has been poverty, inequality, and environmental destruction. What I've sought was the most important thing that one could do to make a positive impact in all of these areas. Instead of taking the babies out of the river, I wanted to know how they were getting in the river at all. It is clear that our economic system is the problem. There is example for enough food and water for all 8 billion people in this world. We do it. We make enough. But the system is incapable of making sure all of those people get it. We live in a system that perpetuates inequality, gives power to those with wealth, and is constantly, constantly growing and destroying the natural world and the climate, which is now devastating. We all know these things. But how to get a handle on the details of this? What specifically has to change to shift the system? We get these stories in our head that we have to do what we're doing, or we have to have some kind of Soviet, Chinese, totalitarian communism. I'm not sure how we got that story, but it is one that we tell. Over the years, I've really grasped for a better understanding of the details of our economic system. I took several economics classes in college. I watched documentaries. I've bought books and read some of them and subscribed to several economic newsletters. And a solid grasp has, in fact, eluded me. Probably the four children, the two master's degrees in completely unrelated topics, jobs, exercise, a love of novels, friends, hiking, and cooking has a role in this. It might have a similar role in your own lives. But other things have also blurred my understanding. Many of the ways our economy works are invisible to us. They work without comment or attention by the magazines we read, by the news, by the places we get information. Just consider how the U.S. media is choosing not to cover interest-free economies, even though an entire country is shifting to this monetary system starting now. I doubt Western financiers are all that interested in us dreaming of those possibilities. It also turns out that some things we were told in school and our economic textbooks were actually wrong and untrue. And we're learning about that in our system when we talk about anti-oppression, anti-racism works, how we were told so many untrue things about what it has meant to be black in America. It's true of our economic system as well. Additionally, economic language is so laden with jargons and equations that it is utterly incomprehensible to regular people most of the time. Reading it is like taking Benadryl, causing almost immediate drowsiness. Also, I'm really suspicious of jargon myself. In my previous life, I helped faculty write research grants, and I would work with them to translate the jargons of their disciplines into English. And what I learned, and this was so disturbing to me, was that jargon often covers sloppy thinking, saying nothing at all, or hiding meaning. This week, I did a deep dive into the inflation problem. The jargon and assumptions that economists make even reading ordinary newspaper articles or podcasts difficult to understand. I listened to a podcast where Jon Stewart interviewed an inflation economist. And I have to tell you, I was entirely pleased to discover he also feels baffled by the issues that baffle me. It made me feel less stupid, I have to say. In a couple of parts, though, in this podcast, I had to stop the video, transcribe the economist's words, find the definitions, and rewrite the sentences with understandable language to know exactly what he was saying. It was exhausting. I did discover that what I had taken as his meaning on the first go wasn't actually exactly right. It was close, but not precise, which ended up mattering to understanding what his argument even was. For all these reasons, I think it is easy enough for all of us to align with economists who seem to have similar political views or assume that mainstream economists have it under control, and so leave the whole matter of our economy and how it works up to the experts. Because truly understanding our economic system is hard. And my experience is that if you feel like you're getting somewhere, what you end up finding is a whole lot of uncertainty and unsubstantiated assumptions. For instance, and maybe you are aware of this, but the most foundational economic assumption by mainstream economists, which is trotted out in the first chapter of almost every economic textbook, is that people will make rational decisions based on the cost and benefits to their lives. Of course, this is totally untrue. Being with people for any extended period of time makes this obvious. I mean, clearly these people did not, I don't know, the people who wrote this weren't hanging out with their families. Furthermore, in the last decades, neuroscientists have definitely buried that idea. People make decisions based on their emotions, even when they think they're behaving rationally. Some economists are working to change the basic assumption of our economic system, but nearly all of the current theory and models are based on this foundational error. There are so many places to dive and explore the mechanisms used to create the capitalistic system we have today, and imagining how they could be recreated to serve our values, that center the worth and dignity of every person, that center democracy, of people having say over the things that they do and that matters to them, interdependence, and peace, and kindness. Today I want to talk about just one aspect of our economy. I could barely tell you, I mean, it's so much. But anyways, so I'm going to talk about one aspect of our economy that affects us all absolutely profoundly and probably most of us don't know about. And that is where money comes from. I literally mean, where does the actual money that we use and spend and get paid come from? How does it enter the economy so people can use it? Most people believe, because we were taught this in school, that the government creates money. The U.S. Constitution gives the government the responsibility of creating our standard currency. That's true. And paper money and coins that we all use are, in fact, printed by the U.S. Treasury. However, 97% of the money in the U.S. economy is electronic money. It is never printed. This is the money in your bank account. This is the money the bank transfers to pay your mortgage or rent or auto payment or electric bill. This money is electronic blips. So where does it come from? Does the government create the money that they spend into the economy by building bridges or paying rangers at national parks? No. Commercial banks create money through loans. Remember in elementary school you were told that people put money in the bank and then the bank lends the money out to people who want to start businesses or buy cars or houses? Well, that was a lie. This is how it actually works. Let's say I want to buy a house. The house costs $500,000. I go to the bank and I sign a note promising to pay the bank back for the loan plus interest. I also get to pay thousands of dollars of fees for that privilege. The bank says, wow, look at this. We have a promissory note for $500,000 on the positive side of our ledger. But we have nothing on the outgoing side. So the bank snaps their fingers, or actually opens my bank account and enters $500,000 into it. Now they balance the promissory note versus the money. But they did not have that money in the first place. They create it. It's a magic trick. And only banks are allowed to do this. I cannot ask Brad to sign a note to me promising to pay me $50 and then just snap my fingers and $50 magically appears, which I hand him, and then he has to pay interest to me for the use of that money. By law, no one can do this but banks. That is how money is created and enters our financial system. I have $500,000 I did not have. I buy a house, and maybe the owners use some of that money to buy a trip to Europe, or maybe they buy a new house and they remodel it. And so $500,000 more is now whirling in the economy, being spent by people. Until I pay my mortgage. Then that $1,000 that I pay toward the principal every month no longer exists as money in the economy. It disappears. If I had spent that money on clothes, the $1,000 would still circulate. But because I pay principal, it does not. The bank keeps the interest, but the principal vanishes from being. Which means the banks kind of are just making something up that they get to charge for, which doesn't seem quite fair. Which means if our economy needs more money in it, this is the point, if our economy needs more money in it because there's more activity that requires people to use money for transactions, somebody has to take out a loan from the bank, which means our entire monetary system only works if people and businesses go into debt. The disaster of this entire system is interest. Nearly all the money in the United States must be paid back with interest. This means debt and interest are foundational to every one of our economic lives, whether we personally are in debt or not. In September of 2018, the combined debt for government, household, and non-financial sector was $51 trillion, which is an unfathomable amount. The interest payments, if the interest was only 3%, and for most debt, it's a lot higher, runs about $1.5 trillion a year. The U.S. government pays about $500 million a year in interest, which we all pay as taxpayers. We all pay more for goods and services because businesses must include interest costs in the price. It also means that all the interest we pay flows into the financial sector as profit. Extra value created by a business flows to the banks first before anything is paid to the owners. And workers and the environment kind of get squeezed so owners can make money and pay the bank. The financial system becomes a magnet for wealth because they get paid first. And we've all seen this in our economy, how those financial people, those bankers, those hedge fund traders, all of those people are the most wealthy in our country. And this is why. And it's one of the major reasons for inequality. Using interest-bearing debt as the way to increase the money supply is the main reason that our economy must grow. The money supply was $14 trillion in 2018, less than a third of the total combined debt. There is no way to pay off the debt because there are literally not enough dollars in the system, and there absolutely never will be. Each year, debt grows, and so does the interest bill. The Alliance for Just Money explains it this way. To feed the expanding debt and the corresponding extraction of value through interest payments, the whole economy has to grow. It has to expand whether we need more goods or services or not. Manufacturing must increase. Sales must increase. Consumption must increase. Businesses have to expand to stay afloat and keep up payments of the interest that debt-based money bears. Their marketing departments are furiously dreaming up more and more clever ways to convince more and more people that they need to buy more and more stuff. Stuff we use valuable resources to produce that often we often send to landfills just a few years later. But none of that matters because you just have to keep getting, the economy just needs to keep burning to make those payments. But we have to keep doing this, they finished, to keep the economy going. So here's the thing. We don't have to do it this way. Other possibilities actually exist. We could create money in exactly the way that most of us imagined it was created. The federal government creates it and spends it into existence. They could pay for things that we believe are really important and aren't profitable. Building schools and bridges, healthcare and art programs. The federal government then wouldn't have to borrow money because they would be creating it. We could live without national debt and government interest payments. Banks could lend out the money they actually have, just like we all have always imagined that it was. There are historical experiments with this. Before the American Revolution, the colonies issued their own money called colonial scrip. Benjamin Franklin credited for the prosperity in the colonies. On a trip to England, he explained of this currency, "We make sure it's issued in proper proportions to make the goods pass easily from the producer to the consumers. In other words, we make sure there is always adequate money in circulation for the needs of the economy. In this manner, by creating ourselves our own paper money, we control its purchasing power, and we have no interest to pay to anyone." You see, a legitimate government can both spend and lend money into circulation, while banks can only lend significant amounts of their promissory banknotes, for they can neither give away nor spend but a tiny fraction of the money that the people need. English bankers were not pleased. They persuaded the British Parliament to pass a law in 1751 that prohibited colonial scrip. The colonists were instead required to use the currency redeemable in gold and silver coins by the banks in England. The money supply was reduced in half. Soon the unemployed were living on the streets, and Franklin believed that this was the true cause of the American Revolution, more than the taxes that we learned about in school. There is an international movement for the public creation of money. In the U.S., several organizations are working on passing the American Monetary Act, an actual bill in Congress, to create public money instead of bank debt-created money. It is a really slow process, passing this or working on this, because the stories we tell about money creation that most of us tell aren't true. And the idea that we allow for-profit bankers who have nothing that they want more than profit to decide how much money is in the economy and what our priorities are as people is so crazy sounding that I have had many well-educated adults flatly tell me that I am confused and I am wrong. But I'm not. You can look it up. It's hard to get the political will to change a system most people don't even understand exists. The work at this phase is just getting people to understand what is true and how the system destroys lives and the planet. Our economic system, this is just one example. Our economic system is woven through with so many ways of doing things that make it impossible for Unitarian Universalist values and our planet to flourish. And so much of this is invisible to us. We need to uncover these. We need to understand. And then we need to use our imagination and our power to transform our economic system so the world we dream of is possible. Please rise and sing with me, "Come and Go to Me with That Land." It's in your hymnals, it's 10:18, and the words will be on the screen, and Spencer will lead us. You really probably don't need to look at the words. It's a zipper song.
Come and go with me to that land. Come and go with me to that land. Come and go with me to that land. Where I'm bound, where I'm bound. Come and go with me to that land. Come and go with me to that land. Come and go with me to that land. Where I'm bound. There'll be freedom in that land. There'll be freedom in that land. There'll be freedom in that land. Where I'm bound, where I'm bound. There'll be freedom in that land. There'll be freedom in that land. There'll be freedom in that land. Where I'm bound. There'll be justice in that land. There'll be justice in that land. There'll be justice in that land. Where I'm bound, there'll be justice in that land. There'll be justice in that land. There'll be justice in that land. Where I'm bound, there'll be singing in that land. There'll be singing in that land. There'll be singing in that land. Where I'm bound, there'll be singing in that land. There'll be singing in that land. There'll be singing in that land. Where I'm bound.
So I'd hoped there would be time for questions, which there is not. So I know that's confusing, and I pretty much left out some important details because there was no time, but if after you get some coffee, if you want to come back to the sanctuary and talk to me about it, I'm totally happy to do that, about the things that I've said. So this is our benediction. Together we turn this world from bleak to bright, one flame, one fire, one light at a time. We conclude our time together by extinguishing our flame of this chalice, but not the warmth and inspiration of our faith, nor our commitment to its principles. These we will carry with us until we meet again.
Carry the flame of peace and love until we meet again. Carry the flame of peace and love until we meet again.